Today is July the 10th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to Hank at pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Amazon officially announced the dates for its fifth annual shopping holiday known as Amazon Prime Day. The now two-day event will span from Monday, July 15th at midnight Pacific time and extend through Tuesday, July 16th, 11:59 p.m. Headlining that list right now is, well, they're keeping it close to the vest. You have to go on site to find out when the sale starts. An estimated 250 competitors that are also hosting sale events on the same days. eBay and Target are planning discount events on their products beginning, you guessed it, on July 15th, eBay's crash sale. Additionally, Target will also be hosting deal days throughout the entirety of Prime Day. And like Amazon, Target did not reveal too much detail as to what to expect, but promised sizable discounts. It's also worth reiterating that Prime Day is reserved for Prime members only, so that may affect where consumers decide to spend their money. But either way, Amazon, in effect, has created a mini Black Friday in July. Toys R Us plans to open 6 U.S. stores in 2019. Richard Barry, formerly of Toys R Us, executive and current CEO of parent company True Kids, Inc., plans to open a half dozen stores at key locations across the United States. The launch would also be accompanied by an e-commerce site that could go live as early as, well, before the Christmas holiday season. Many former Toys R Us and Babies R Us stores have already been gobbled up by various other companies. The old Babies R Us is now Giant Fitness. In addition to downsizing, True Kids Inc. is also concocting other ways to keep costs down. The brand may opt to seek a consignment arrangement with vendors rather than just buy goods from suppliers. That means toy makers will ship goods to them but only receive payment as their products are purchased. This market needs a self-standing toy store, that's for sure. Brick-and-mortar stores give us the opportunity to see the product before purchase. It is foolhardy to make purchases sight unseen and based only just on online reviews. Walmart is expected to lose at least $1 billion this year in its e-commerce division and may sell off money-losing units as the retail giant struggles to compete with Amazon. Walmart's effort to challenge Amazon are falling short, leading to internal strains and push to curb losses in its e-commerce division. The unit is projecting losses of over $1 billion in revenues, between $21 to $22 billion. Walmart is frustrated with Jet, an online shopping site it purchased for $3.3 billion back in 2016. Walmart's board of directors want the online business to cut losses. Walmart will look to sell at least one of three fashion brands. All three businesses are unprofitable. That move came on the heels of a strong quarter in which online sales rocketed 43%. Increase in revenue does not translate into profit. Walmart has no more than 20 warehouse distribution centers currently, while Amazon has 110. That's where the difference is. Our advice is buy what you need for today. Tomorrow when you need it, the products will be cheaper and newer. You don't need to create a stock room of great bargains with a price tag still affixed to it. The Nikkei Asian Review reports chunks of production out of China for Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and the main areas of concern are gaming consoles, e-readers, and smart speakers. For Dell and HP, notebooks are where they're looking to shift production. They also reported that Apple wants to reduce its exposure to China because of uncertainty around the trade war. The U.S. tech giants, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Dell, and HP, are all gearing up to start shifting production away from China amid the trade war. The five companies have been scouting various other Asian countries as possible new homes for electronics production. This is the latest chapter in the tech cold war that has snowballed substantially amid the trade war with China. Last month, Apple was seriously considering moving 15 to 30% of its iPhone production out of China, which is an early sign of U.S. companies wanting to reduce their exposure to the country. Game consoles and smart speakers are the primary concerns for the Silicon Valley giants Google, Amazon, and Microsoft, along with Sony and Nintendo. Amazon is looking at moving production of its e-readers and Echo smart speakers to Vietnam. Microsoft is weighing Thailand and Indonesia, presumably for production of the Xbox, as well as its lesser-known Cortana speaker. There are no details about where Google might consider moving production of its Google Home smart speakers. U.S. tariffs pose an existential threat to video game consoles. Last week, Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo wrote a joint letter to the U.S. government asking that game consoles be left off any tariff list because of the disproportionate harm tariffs would cause to U.S. consumers and businesses. For Dell and HP, notebook computers are the main area where the companies are said to be looking to move production. The two companies shipped a combined 70 million notebook devices last year, most of which were made in China. Dell is already, on a trial basis, manufacturing notebooks in Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines. HP is looking to shift 20 to 30% of production out of the country and was considering Thailand and Taiwan as alternatives. The changes could begin as early as late July. Google, Amazon, and Dell were not immediately available for comment when contacted. Microsoft and HP declined to comment on the report, although an HP spokesman said in a statement, "HP shares industry concerns that broad-based tariffs harm consumers by increasing the cost of electronics. We are actively monitoring the situation and will continue to work with government officials to advocate for the best interests of customer partners and consumers." What had happened in the past was that these companies were manufacturing all in one place, putting everything in one basket. This is now a more intelligent move to distribute the manufacturer to different places, so any trade agreements with any other country would be limited in scope. China forces malware on tourist phones at border. A set of publications took the time to travel to China to investigate a claim that China installed malware on tourist phones at their borders. As it turned out, this practice didn't occur at every single station, but it was certainly happening, and it was government sanctioned. This app was extremely blatant in its techniques and searches. At the border to China, agents collected smartphones from tourists entering the country from Kyrgyzstan, installed malware, and returned said phones to their owners. The malware is apparently still being installed on phones today. The malware takes the form of an app called Cell Hunter or Mobile Hunter and is relatively easy to remove, or so it would seem. Publications, Vice the Guardian and the New York Times, crossed the border to see if the tip reports of malware insertion in phones at the border was accurate. Indeed, that was the situation. Thanks to the combined efforts of the above publications, they posted the app over on the hosting site GitHub, making it available there for download and analysis all over the internet. Well, what can the app do? The app is like an octopus spreading its many arms out, seeking data of many sorts. one ID write file, removable by the agent after the initial scan, turn up a simple list of usernames, passwords, and more. File content scan results by China Border Malware included the following: mobile wallet login info, mobile carry info, records with login, a Facebook-like social network text log, file content and text message logs, Alibaba login info and history cache, phone numbers, Android-based maps, location history, Android-based file content cache, Weibo login file content cache, and a whole lot more, like a phone's manufacturer, model, Android version, Wi-Fi address, Bluetooth Mac, and much more information. These items are only the bits collected by default, if present in the phone. Analyzation also includes the flagging of items of interest for the border officers doing the scanning. A list of approximately 73,315 items was turned up by the analysis in part by this investigation. If any of these items is found on a device, the owner will be questioned further by the officer, and, well, they may be detained after the questioning. While the app analyzed here was Android-based, iPhone scanning was also done via USB connection. The device that connected to each iPhone was not available for this analysis. Last Friday, an earthquake measuring 6.4 hit Southern California. On the same day, What Me Worry, Mad Magazine announced they would cease publishing new material after 67 years of a long run. Mad, the long-running satirical magazine that influenced everyone from Weird Al Yankovic to the writers of The Simpsons, will be leaving newsstands after its August issue. The illustrated humor magazine, instantly recognizable by the gap-toothed smiling face of mascot Alfred E. Newman, will still be available in comic shops and through mail to subscribers. But after its fourth issue, it will just reprint previously published material. After 67 years, the iconic Mad Magazine will no longer be releasing original content on a bi-monthly basis. In just a few weeks' time, the well-known satirical publication, recently revamped by DC Comics, will only offer vintage material and end-of-year specials. Fans of the parody magazine can still pick up these issues at comic shops or have them mailed to their home via subscription. Mad is an institution with a rich history. Founded by Harvey Kurtzman and William Gaines in 1952, Mad fast cemented itself as the gold standard in placing a crack and comedic mirror up to society and pop culture, unafraid to critique everything from politics to movies and TV shows. The magazine became immortalized with some help from its gap-toothed and freckled mascot, Alfred E. Newman, who is instantly recognizable by the gap-toothed smiling face. Alfred E. Newman is the fictitious mascot and cover boy of the American humor magazine Mad. The middle name with the E initial stood for Enigma, and the character face had drifted through U.S. iconography for decades and appeared in the early 1930s on a presidential campaign postcard with the caption, "Sure, I'm for Roosevelt." Alfred E. Newman, with his famous catchphrase of "What Me Worry," is said to emphasize one's calm, perhaps cavalier attitude. As Newman would say, "What me worry? Worry not, for Mad has more than 550 issues packed full of political parodies and edgy humor to pull from." Mad Magazine also had a character named Moxie Koznovsky, which was introduced in the late 1950s as a female companion for Alfred. She made only a handful of cover appearances, possibly due to the fact she looked alarmingly like her significant other. The news of Mad, the last of print parody publication after the physical termination of Spy and The Onion, no longer releasing new content, was mourned far and wide on social media by folks like Rob Delaney, Mark Hamill, Weird Al Yankovic, and director Brad Bird. John Carpenter even joked that the 6.4 earthquake in Los Angeles was heavenly punishment for the magazine's cancellation. One of Mad's best-known comic series, Spy vs. Spy, featured two spies with beak-like faces and big eyes, wearing costumes that are still regularly worn on Halloween. Of course, one wore white and one wore black. That was Spy vs. Spy, created by, believe it or not, a suspected spy. Cuban cartoonist Antonio Projas was disenchanted with the regime under Fidel Castro when he began working on what would become Spy vs. Spy. Mad Magazine, as fast as popular culture could erect wholesome depictions of American life in comics, television, or movies, Mad Magazine was there to tear them all down. Mad is an American humor magazine founded in 1952 by editor Harvey Kurtzman and publisher William Gaines, launched as a comic book before it became a magazine. Rest in peace. The millennial generation, over 80 million strong, is America's largest, eclipsing the current size of the post-war baby boom generation. Millennials make up nearly a quarter of the total U.S. population. Millennials overwhelmingly say they prefer paper, and in fact, 60 out of 66 students surveyed preferred paper over computers and mobile devices when studying. It is often thought that the generation of student may fully adapt to the new technology. The truth is that nearly everyone still has a preference for paper. Some even say that they felt they performed better when reading on paper rather than on a screen. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell in his continuing IT Pro series. This week he covers paperless office dreams.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to cover some of the relationship with work technology and how it mixes with the personal. And I want to go back in time. I worked for an aerospace manufacturer, a subcontractor, technically, a number of years ago. Now, they made a number of different parts for airplanes. Or actually, the aerospace industry, so some of it went on rockets, and you got the idea there. One of those pieces of metal, let's just explore something very simple, the leading edge of a wing. Now, we imagine that leading edge of the wing, if we were going to put together a contract and all of the different paperwork that would be involved with just that simple little curve that folds around the front of the wing, you might say, oh, it'll take 20 pieces of paper, 100 pieces of paper. How about this? 1,500 pieces of paper. Wow. That's a lot of paper. Look around your office. How much paper do you see in your office? See, we found that that paper was slowing us down. We would store all kinds of different contract information and all kinds of different information in regards to, yes, we used this particular piece of metal, we used this particular bolt, and this is the heat treat that it had on the metal, this is who worked on that piece of metal, this is who put that particular bolt in that particular, you get the idea, you track everything. It's almost unfathomable how much paperwork goes behind something that is, well, the 747 or the space shuttle. And people do complain, oh yes, this hammer, which is $7 at the local Home Depot, is actually $55 when it's sold to NASA. Well, that's because there's a lot of specification, a lot of identification. See, that hammer has to go into space. And if anything goes wrong with that hammer, somebody's going to be in trouble. There's insurance involved with that hammer. There's insurance involved with getting it up there. There's making sure that they use the right hammer, that they get the right hammer up into space. I want you to think about this. It costs actually a lot more to put that hammer into space than it costs to buy it. But that's another story altogether. It's thousands of dollars per pound to put something into space. So paper was slowing us down. to the tune of this. We had three employees that were dedicated towards locating paperwork within the office, within all of our filing cabinets, within all of our those bankers' boxes. And they were all over the company. Wherever we could find a place to store this paperwork, we would, as long as it was safe. And, you know, you have to do that. You know, if an airplane falls out of the sky, this is kind of creepy, gruesome initially, but they want to find out why it fell out of the sky. They want to find out what went wrong with it. So the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, will chase down every bit of information that they can in regards to that plane. Okay, it was this plane. It was, okay, this particular part of the wing. It was this, oh, it was this bolt right here that was the problem. So then they can trace that all the way back, all the way down to the paperwork and who made the problem so that no more planes fall out of the air. Now, we employed three people full time to track all of that paperwork, to store it, to locate more paperwork and more. That's a lot of time invested in this. We went eventually paperless, or mostly paperless. You can't truly go paperless, but you can increase the actions within your company to ensure that you are going as close to paperless as you can. So when contracts came in, we worked on putting them into a digital form. We actually had a software package that tracked all of the different pieces of paper that were scanned or they were put in digitally, and we could search across all of that information. And sometimes it was a matter of, yes, we're searching for this particular code here. It's going to be this project. It's going to be this particular part. And then we could pull that up. We could do the search, and it would bring up everything we needed to know about it. Symantec did a little bit of research recently. They found out that half of the respondents to their survey thought that half of their organization's value was tied up in information. How much of your business's value, you know, the company you work for, how much of it is locked up in hard to find, hard to share, hard to use paper documents? Most companies, it's a lot. Think of all of the file cabinets we have everywhere. And if we move towards paperless, if we move towards some of these document imaging solutions, we can scale down everything that we're storing in paper. But we also wind up with another benefit. If we're storing that paper digitally instead of physically, we're reducing the risk of fires. We're also reducing the amount of paper that's being used. We're actually being better for the environment by eliminating all of the different dead trees that we're killing off. This is actually really exciting. Companies that are going through this kind of process, two-thirds of them found out that they had a payback within 18 months. Us, within a matter of a year, we had paid off the software. We had shifted those three employees to some other areas of the company, fortunately, because we were growing and we were able to access information a lot faster. This was an amazing approach for us. We enjoyed it. It's something you might check out sometime soon as well. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. How relevant is radio today? Do people really still listen to the radio? They sure do, even young people. Deloitte Global predicts that global radio revenue will reach $40 billion in the United States this year, a 1% increase over 2018. Here are some facts. 85% of the adult population listening to the radio at least weekly in the developed world. 3 billion people worldwide will listen to radio weekly. Deloitte Global predicts that adults globally will listen to an average of 90 minutes of radio a day. Radio will continue to perform relatively well with younger demographics in the United States. More than 90% of 18 to 34-year-olds, which are millennials, will listen to radio at least weekly in 2019, and they will listen to radio for an average of more than 80 minutes a day. TV viewing among the millennials in the United States, however, is falling at 3 times the rate of radio listening. At current rates of decline, Americans 18 to 34 will likely spend more time listening to radio than watching traditional TV by 2025. Radio is the voice whispering in our ear, in the background of dinner, in an office, or while driving the car. Where is all this data coming from? Radio listening data is collected using passive technology devices worn by consumers that pick up radio programs. In the United States, AM/FM radio listening activity is measured by Nielsen in 48 major markets. The measurement is done passively through a wearable device called a personal people meter, that's PPM, and in smaller markets, a diary system is used. Each year, about 400,000 Americans participate in the measurement of program listening. Radio listening is less obtrusive than TV and less novel than watching video on a smartphone. It is often perceived as merely background to a lunch or a commuter's drive, but the radio is on. The sound is coming out of the speakers and our ears are hearing the radio, even if we're not consciously reminding ourselves, hey, we're listening to the radio. Radio's weekly reach, the percentage of people who listen to radio at least once a week, has been remarkably stable in the United States. Not only has reach hovered around 94% for the last few years, but that number is essentially unchanged from 94.9% in 2001. When considering radio's attractiveness, it is important to note that radio's popularity is likely due to dominance of radio being listened to in cars. When one talks about the global radio industry, the size of the U.S. market driven by its large population, radio's high reach into this population, and the very high value per capita of U.S. radio listeners make it represent over half of all global radio revenues in 2017. The bottom line is that the obvious implication of all the aforementioned aspects is that radio is not going away. If these results reflect typical attitudes, radio appears to be the most undervalued medium for brand building. Most people in the media industry hold negative assumptions about radio's effectiveness, largely due to entrenched myths that denigrates radio's reach and daily listening minutes, its popularity with young audiences, and its demographics with regard to income and education. The industry itself is partially to blame for these misunderstandings. It is widely assumed that the most common venue where North America dial in their car. This is true. Around 90% of radio listeners in the United States do listen while in the car. But the flip side of the belief that North American listens to radio only in their cars needs some myth-busting. While not as prevalent, people in North America definitely are listening to the radio in places other than cars. About half of North Americans aged 25 to 75 listen to radio while at home, although only 42% of millennials do so. A non-trivial proportion are also listening at work, with the percentage being highest for 18 to 24-year-olds and at 30% declining to half of that for those aged 55 to 75 years of age. Perhaps our most challenging finding is that there is no single powerful universal reason that people who listen to the radio decide to listen to the radio. Should a radio broadcaster spend a lot of money on attracting top DJs or hosts for the program? Playing new music so that listeners can discover new acts works well for millennials, with 36% saying that this is one of the reasons they listen to the radio at all. But only half that proportion of the 55 to 75-year-olds listen to radio for discovery. For some demographics, the facts that radio is live, free, and easy to listen to in the car were the only reasons that more than half of the radio listeners gave for listening. The decline in TV watching by young people has gone down by about 60% in the last 6 to 7 years, suggests that TV almost certainly faces challenges ahead. Radio has no such crisis or looming demographics to worry about. Many things have changed since the year 1962, in which a hit movie, American Feedy, was set. But driving around in a car and listening to music, news, and a loudmouth DJ is still very much of the U.S. cultural fabric in 2019, in a world where digital changes everything, and radio may be the exception. The evolving radio platform. Over-the-air radio is one of the media which covers a huge swath of the population. The broadcast is one to many. The basic conventional radio set is inexpensive, and the reception is free. The area of coverage is local or regional. Many Android smartphones today have FM reception coverage. This enhances the portability and reception of the radio program. The smartphone functions as a portable radio set. Unfortunately, Apple's iPhone architecture precludes FM reception. Internet radio enables the listener to access any live broadcast globally. The traditional internet cable access tethers the listener to a fixed location. However, with the advent of Wi-Fi internet access, the radio broadcast program can be received anywhere. There are, however, expenses for this type of internet access, and it will take time for prices to come down and for the technology to be available globally. An Android smartphone with FM reception is now the new standard norm and also the Swiss knife for the portable radio. It can receive non-internet FM broadcasts as well as internet radio broadcasts. Then there are podcasts. People listen to podcasts when they are looking for a more conversational medium to provide them with information. People listen to podcasts for leisure, business, and for other reasons. Podcasts are perfect for long car rides or when you're in between activities. Today, downloading and streaming over the internet offer individualized content for each listener. Does the internet and streaming mean that broadcasts over the air radio is dying? History tells us that a new medium does not mean the death of old media. There usually is room for all, although some evolutionary morphing usually does occur. The challenge is understanding and predicting that change and benefiting from it. But not everyone has internet access. About 23% of people in urban areas don't have access to or can't afford broadband versus 28% in rural areas. These numbers are not insignificant. For those without internet, the over-the-air television and radio broadcasts are still relevant. There are about 500 million radio receivers in the United States. During times of emergencies, they are frequently the only way to receive news and know what is happening. Over-the-air radio broadcast is still highly popular. It is the cheapest and available method for transmission of news and advertising. Another point is that radio facilities placed in many cars, trains, phones, and so on, and this makes it much simpler to hear radio than read a book on the way to work. Radio devices now are small in comparison with TV sets and computers. Long live the radio set. It's always a time for anxiety when traveling by airplane. You know the drill. There are these plastic trays that you place your computer notebook. You use another one for electronics such as camera and cell phone. And you need another one for your shoes. And let's not forget the carry-on that just passes through the scanner separately. The security lines are long and the TSL personnel do try to efficiently move the crowd through. But the line can only just go so fast as passengers retrieving their items have to put their shoes on before they move away. And trays do get out of order when one of them is held up for more detailed review. I went through this procedure recently on a trip, and when retrieving everything being scanned, I asked the TSA agent, "Where was my cell phone? I didn't see it coming through." The agent didn't have an answer. My wife, fortunately, had been processed ahead of me, and I just asked her to just call the cell phone. The ringing sound located the cell phone. The trays being pushed through got out of order, but what if you couldn't locate your missing cell phone and calling it was futile? Worse yet, your cell phone might have been stolen or snatched from you. What do you do? Lost the stolen Android phone? Here's how to get it back. It can happen to anyone, but there are steps you can take to recover your lost or stolen phone. It only takes a few seconds. You leave your phone on a counter in the store and walk away, or someone bumps into you on the street and lifts your phone right out of your pocket or bag without you even noticing it. Losing a phone, be it from theft or an honest mistake, is a stressful experience. Not only does it cut off your access to the rest of the world, but your phone is the most personal device you own. In the event your phone goes missing, don't panic. There are tools built into every Android phone that makes it possible to lock and track down a lost phone with ease. But first, you'll need to take some steps to set yourself up for success. Create a secure lock screen. Do yourself a favor and turn on passcode and fingerprint authentication if it's available. Do yourself another favor and don't use facial recognition on your Android device. The technology used for facial recognition on most Android devices can be easily tricked with something as simple as a photo of your face. Facial authentication could get more secure if Android Q does indeed add official support for secure face ID-like authentication to Android, as reports have suggested. Next, create your passcode and set up fingerprint authentication in the Settings app under the Security section. I realize scanning a fingerprint or entering a PIN code every time you want to use your phone, well, it can be inconvenient. But the idea of someone having access to your photos, banking information, email, and the rest of your personal data is downright scary. An extra step to unlock your phone is worth the effort when you consider the potential impact of exposing your personal info to a stranger. There's also the Google Find My Device. Make sure Google's Find My Device is turned on. Anytime you sign into an Android device with a Google account, Find My Device is already on. Find My Device is what you'll use should your phone ever go missing to track remotely locked and remotely erase it. You can check to make sure Find My Device is enabled by opening the Settings app and going to Security and Location, Find My Device, and alternatively, if your device doesn't have a Security and Location option, go to Google, Security, Find My Device. Find My Device should be turned on, and if not, slide the switch over to the on position and exit out of the setting apps. If you follow these instructions, and if your phone is missing, at least you have a way of trying to find where it is. Presenting Marty Winston on his viewpoint on counterproductive ducks. We are in the beginning of a summer, and the nation as a whole is experiencing heat in abundance.
I want to start with the basics, but I've been thinking about this. You really have to go back to the caveman era. So imagine you're back then, it's cold out, you build a fire. How close are you? Well, you gather close to the fire, but the distance is going to balance the heat of the fire with the cold of your surroundings. It's a comfort zone, and come to think of it, cave dweller leg muscles must have been the first thermostats. But let's think for a minute about how humanity adapted the first simple fires to make them a little more useful. If you're at the mouth of the cave, where I assume you're going to build the fire to keep smoke from being an issue, you still have to deal somewhat with the smoke. Away from the cave, as we got out of the caves, got into animal hide lean-to shelters, well, those became teepees so you could have a fire indoors. Teepees and other teepee-like shapes would let smoke rise out and opening at their apex. And smoke is the first of the secondary attributes of a fire that people sought to control. They already knew how to control primary attributes like size and location. So guiding smoke out a deliberate path evolved into, well, you know, chimneys and smokestacks. And fires on the ground evolved into fireplaces inside constructed dwellings, initially huts and then cabins and so on. The fireplace also developed an offshoot, the cook stove. Hang on, I'm almost where I want to bring you. As those constructed dwellings got larger and more complex, there were sometimes multiple fireplaces, plus a cook stove, plus enclosed but chimney-connected small stoves that could heat, for example, a bedroom. In time, a single boiler could distribute heated water, or later steam, through piping that could reach every room and use a contrivance called a radiator to heat each room. A few boilers in the early era were wood-fired, many were coal-fired, and later heating oil became popular. But let's bring this forward to the somewhat more modern times, when electricity first became available, and with it, the ability to involve fans and blowers. Somebody got the idea of building something like one big radiator right at the boiler. You can skip the water here because I'm talking about how the home furnace came to be. Putting a big blower fan there and, like sideways chimneys, sending the heat through the house through big tubes that evolved into familiar ventilation ductwork. Ducts. That's my focus this time. What they're supposed to do, and a whole bunch of things they also do. Things you may not think about right away, but when you do think about them, oh, there are things that may move your mood to disappointed, or maybe even beyond, to angry. First, I should acknowledge that your house may not have ducts. There are three different ways that heating or cooling can happen in a house. One is room by room, using things like space heaters or window air conditioners. One way is a central heat pump, which is a combined HVAC system. HVAC, by the way, stands for heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. Or instead of a heat pump, you may have a separate central furnace and separate central air conditioner, but both connected to the same ductwork. The third way is a split system, where a central unit heats or cools a refrigerant fluid that gets pumped through pipes or hoses to units about the size of a bakery loaf of Italian bread in the various rooms. Hey, you have what you have, and if your house doesn't have ductwork, a lot of what I'm about to tell you is nothing you need to worry over. But if you do have ducts, well, keep your grimace at the ready and a frown on deck. Let's start with peace and privacy, and another piece of the past to help explain it. In the years before shipboard electronics, the captain could issue commands to other parts of the ship through a speaking tube, which was essentially an air pipe or air hose, usually 1.5 to 2.5 inches in diameter, with cones on both ends, able to allow voice communication over hundreds of feet. Know it's an even bigger tube? Yep, ventilation ducts are an even more open acoustic channel. So if you're hearing conversations in other rooms or they're hearing you, it could be coming through your ducts. Annoying, isn't it? Not only does it interrupt your peace and quiet, it can also compromise your privacy. But while we're thinking about noise, let's talk about another little annoyance you probably thought was unavoidable. It's a lot of hot air, or cold air, or whatever air is blowing through your ducts at the time. That low rumbling sound, well, it's an unnecessary source of noise pollution. We've all been inside concrete garages with hard walls and heard echoes from every big or little sound we make. Hard walls make sounds bounce, and if they're thin hard walls, like the steel sides of most ductwork, they can also amplify the noise through resonance and point it right at you, like the horn on a loudspeaker. So, okay, inside the rooms of your house, ducts bring eavesdropping and blow noises and other acoustic annoyances, and all those things are what you observe from, again, inside the rooms of a house. But next, let's go inside the walls. Most modern ducts are made of metal, usually steel or aluminum, as either cylindrical or rectangular tubes. If I just tell you that both metals are thermally conductive, you might gloss by the words, so let's turn up the heat. In fact, let's do that at your stove. Aren't a lot of your pots and pans made of aluminum or steel? When you heat up their outsides, do the insides get hot or stay cool? Well, it's how you cook. They get hot. They wouldn't be very good for cooking if they didn't get hot. Heat on one side of the metal quickly appears on the other side. Not just heat. Grab another pot, dump some ice cubes in it, sit it on a counter, count to 25, and touch the outside of the pot. Cold, right? I'll get into passing the hot and the cold in a minute, but there's something else that also happens inside the walls. You probably know that metals expand when you heat them and contract when you cool them. Yeah, that happens to your ducts when hot or cold air blows through them. It isn't a big change in size. It doesn't need to be. It still creates a small but real air tunnel between the ducts and any insulation inside the walls. And that's happening exactly where the insulation was thinner anyway because it had to make room for the duct. So, yeah, there is some heat leakage through the walls and some air leakage along that path. And the path itself may be exploited by uninvited insects. But the expansions and contractions do something worse. They help unseal the system. Ducts are set up in a trunking arrangement. The biggest sizes, meaning bigger cross-section measurements, are feeders. Those branch off into smaller secondary trunks, or they may branch directly into the several individual runs that terminate in your room ventilation registers. And it's the same again with the flow going the other way for the cold air returns. It all has to do with having enough forward air pressure, enough blow, to deliver the airflow everywhere without creating a level of back pressure that can destroy, and I'm being literal with that word, quite effectively destroy the central system. That means there are lots of connections en route, places where one length of ductwork connects with the next, or with the endpoint register through a transition fixture called a boot. And every time there's a connection, there's a chance that it will be an imperfect connection. HVAC professionals have a lot of ways to address that, from the classic duct tape to the white or silver sealing tapes to rubbery coatings. But when the ducts themselves expand and contract, the tape or goo or whatever is there to seal them can work loose. When it does, there's an air leak. The air leak means some of the heating or cooling goes to waste, but that's not the worst of it. Remember, the thermostat is just going to make everything stay on longer until the house gets to whatever target temperature you set. The more the ducts can leak, the harder the system has to work, and that extra wear and tear comes with a huge repair or replacement bill when central systems prematurely fail. It can cost thousands of dollars. Oh, do I suddenly have a little more of your attention? Those failed-before-their-time incidents accompany just about every kind of energy waste that can happen with something as fundamentally basic as a duct. And that brings us back to those metal pots, one getting hot inside when it's on the stove and one getting cold outside when there's ice in it. Do you have a basement or a crawl space? Can you see the long runs of ductwork that cross between the joists? If those aren't insulated, try taking temperature measurements every few feet. It's amazing how many degrees their temperature can change in just a few yards of length. It's not just that they're delivering not-so-cool cooling or not-so-hot heating to the registers, but that they're overcooling or overheating the area immediately surrounding those initial lengths. For example, with a first-floor thermostat set in the low 70s, probably where you put it, set it in the low 70s in the cooling season, you could have a basement space in the mid-60s, and the second-floor rooms could be heading for the low 80s. So if they're not insulated, the metal ducts that are intended to create more comfortable quarters may, in fact, create more discomfort and cost and expensive early-onset system failures. Those are counterproductive ducts. There are answers. An HVAC pro can outline most of them. My solution here is double wall insulated flexible ducts. They're easier to completely seal. They very much reduce room-to-room noise. They maintain the starting point air temperature over a much longer run. They solve a lot of problems. They're ducts that conduct themselves better. I'll tell you more about them in a few weeks. Next time, I want to get into something that really bugs me. Bugs all over our wooded hilltop biosphere, and about things I'm doing as I work on debugging the biosphere, mostly automatically, without doing SWAT.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Apple seeds and Apple devices Thursday, July 11th, and they meet at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and their location is 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on recycling e-waste and pioneering urban sustainability, Thursday, July 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on web design, Thursday, July 11th, and the presentation is at 7 p.m., and this was originally rescheduled from the first week of July 4th. Obviously, it's a national holiday, so they moved it to the following week. They meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, July 12th at 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, and it's located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, July the 23rd, and they meet at 7 p.m., and it's at the Mercer County Library, located at Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, July the 25th. Starting time is 6:45 p.m., and there will be a presentation on Hard Disk Sentinel, which is a monitoring and analysis software, and iCloud integrating Apple and non-Apple devices. They meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has no meeting scheduled for the summer until September the 3rd, but they normally meet at the Danbury Hackerspace at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. We hope to see you at one of these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.